Chapter 1. The old desk. Not one of my keys will fit it. The old desk has been laid aside for years, and is covered with dust and rust. We do not make such strong boxes nowadays, for brass hinges and secret drawers have given place to flimsy Morocco and Russian leather, so we clap a Brahma lock, that Brahma himself cannot pick, on a black bag that the veriest bungler can rip open in 5 seconds with a penknife, and entrust our notes, bank and otherwise, our valuables, and our secrets, to this faithless repository with a confidence that deserves to be respected. But in the days when George III was king, our substantial ancestors rejoiced in more substantial workmanship, so the old desk that I cannot succeed in unlocking, is of shining rosewood, clamped with brass, and I shall spoil it sadly with the mallet and the chisel. What a medley it holds! Thank heaven I am no speculative philosopher, or I might moralize for hours over its contents. First, out flies a withered leaf of geranium. It must have been dearly prized once, or it would never have been here. Maybe it represented the hopes, the wealth, the all in all of two aching hearts, and they are dust and ashes now. To think that the flower should have outlasted them. The symbol less perishable than the faith. Then I come to a piece of much begrimed and yellow paper, carefully folded, and endorsed with a date, a receipt for an embrocation warranted specific in all cases of bruises, sprains, or lumbago, next a gold pencil case, with the head of Socrates for a seal, lastly, much of that substance which is generated in all waste places, and which the vulgar call flu. How it comes there puzzles equally the naturalist and the philosopher, but you shall find it in empty corners, empty drawers, empty pockets, nay, we believe in its existence in the empty heads of our fellow creatures. In my thirst for acquisition, regardless of dusty fingers, I press the inner sides of the desk in hopes of discovering secret springs and hoarded repositories. So if poor men e'er now found 1,000-pound notes hid away in chinks and crannies, and straightway, giddy with the possession of boundless wealth, have gone to the devil at a pace such as none but the beggar on horseback can command, so have old wills been fished out, and frauds discovered, and rightful heirs re-established, and society in general disgusted, and all concern made discontented and uncomfortable social eye, perhaps but the springs work, a false lid flies open, and I do discover a packet of letters, written on thin foreign paper, in the free straggling characters I remember so well. They are addressed to Sir H. Beverley, and the hand that penned them has been cold for years. So will yours and mine be someday, perhaps ere the flowers are out again. Will you drink a glass less claret on that account? Buxom Mrs. Lalagy, shall the dressmaker therefore put unbecoming trimmings in your bonnet? The shining hours are few, and soon past, make the best of them, each in your own way, only try and choose the right way, dash. For the day will soon be over, and the minutes are of gold, and the wicket shuts at sundown, and the shepherd leaves the fold. Letter I. Those were merry days, my dear Hal, when we used to hear the chimes at midnight with poor Brummel and Sir Benjamin. Very jolly times they were, and I often think, if health and pockets could have stood it, I should like to be going the pace amongst you all still. And yet how few of us are left. They have dropped off one by one, as they did the night we dyed the white rose red at the old place, and you, and I, and staunch old Ben, were the only three left that could walk straight. Do you remember the corner of King Street, and Ben stripped to the buff, as he called it himself, going in right royally at the tall fellow with the red head? I never saw such right and lefters, I never thought he had so much fight in him, and you don't remember, Hal, but I do, how the lass with the long locks bent over you when you were floored, like Andromache over a debauched Hector, and staunched the claret that was flowing freely from your nostrils, and gave you gin in a smelling bottle, which you sucked down as though it were mother's milk, like a young reprobate as you were. Nor do you remember, nor do I very clearly, how we all got back to the cottage, and finished with burnt curagoa, and a dance on the table by daylight. And now you and I are about the only two left, and I am as near ruined as a gentleman can be, and you must have lost your pen feathers, Hal, I should think, though you were a goose that always could pick a living off a common, be it never so bare. Well, we have had our fun, and after all, I for one have been far happier since than I ever was in those roistering days, but of this I cannot bear to speak. The dandy's nickname for the Prince Regent. Nor am I so much to be pitied now. I have got my colors and my sketchbook, after all, and there never was such a country as this for a man who has half an eye in his head. On these magnificent plains the lights and shades are glorious. Glorious, Hal, with a little red jagged in here and there towards sunset, and the ghostly maize waving and whispering, and the feathery acacias trembling in the lightest air, the russet tinge of the one and the fawn-colored stems of the other melting so softly into the neutral tints of the sandy soil. I could paint a picture here that should be perfectly true to nature, nay, more natural than the old dame herself, and never use but two colors to do it all. I am not going to tell you what they are, and this reminds me of my boy, and of a want in his organization that is a sad distress to me. The child has not a notion of color. I was painting out of doors yesterday, and he was standing by, bless him. He never leaves me for an instant, and I tried to explain to him some of the simplest rudiments of the godlike art. "There," said I, "do you see those red tints on the tops of the far acacias, and the golden tinge along the back of that brown ox in the foreground?" "Yes, Papa," was the child's answer, with a bewildered look. "How should you paint them, my boy?" "Well, Papa, I should paint the acacias green, because they underscore green," and here he thought he had made a decided hit. "I should put the red into the ox, for he is almost more red than brown." Dear child! He has not a glimmering of color, but composition, that's his forte, and drawing, you know, which is the highest form of the art. His drawing is extraordinary careless, but great breadth and freedom, and I am certain he could compose a wonderful picture, from his singular sensibility to beauty. Young as he is, I have seen the tears stand in his eyes when contemplating a fine view, or a really exquisite bit, such as one sees in this climate every day. His raptures at his first glimpse of the Danube I shall never forget, and if I can only instill into him the principles of color, you will see Vere will become the first painter of the age. The boy learns languages readily enough. He has picked up a good deal of Hungarian from his nurse. Such a woman, Hal! Magnificent! Such coloring, deep brown tones, and masses of the richest gray hair, with superb, solemn, sunken eyes, and a throat and forehead tanned and wrinkled into the very ideal of a Canidia, or a witch of Endor, or any fine old sorceress, all of the olden time. I have done her in chalks, and in sepia, and in oils. I adore her in the former. She is, I fancy, a good, careful woman, and much attached to Vere, who promises to be an excellent linguist, but of this I cannot see the advantage. There is but one pursuit, in my opinion, for an intellectual being who is not obliged to labor in the fields for his daily bread, and that is art. I have wooed the heavenly maid all my life. To me she has been sparing of her favors, and yet a single smile from her has gilded my path for many a long and weary day. She has beckoned me on and on till I feel I could follow her to the end of the world. She shielded me underscore in the dark hour underscore. She has brightened my lot ever since. She led me to nature, her grand reflection, for you know my theory, that art is reality, and nature but the embodiment of art. She has made me independent of the frowns of that other jade, fortune, and taught me the most difficult lesson of all, to be content. What is wealth? You and I have seen it lavished with both hands, and its possessor weary, satiate, languid, and disgusted. What is rank? A mark for envy, an idol but for fools. Fame? A few orders on a tight uniform, a craving for more and more, even when we know the tastelessness of the food, to be still hungry for applause. Love? A sting of joy and a heartache forever. Are they not all vanity of vanities? But your artist is your true creator. He can embody the noblest aspirations of his mind, and give them a reality and a name. You, Hal, who are the most practical, unimaginative, business-like fellow that ever hedged a bet or drove a bargain, have had such dreams betwixt sleeping and waking as have given you a taste of heaven, and taught you the existence of a fairyland of which, to such as you, is only granted a far away and occasional glimpse. What would you give to be able to embody such blissful visions and call them up at will? Let me have a camel's hairbrush, a few dabs of clay, and, behold, I am the magician before whose wand these dreams shall reappear tangibly, substantially, enduringly, alas! For mortal shortcomings, sometimes a little out of drawing, sometimes a little hard and cold, but still, Hal, I can make my own world, such as it is, and people it for myself, nor do I envy any man on earth, except, perhaps, a sculptor. To have perfected and wrought out in the imperishable marble the ideal of one's whole life, to walk round it, and smoke one's cigar and say, this will last as long as St. Paul's Cathedral or the National Debt, and this is mine, I made it, must be a sensation of delight that even we poor painters, with our works comparatively of a day, can hardly imagine. But then, what we lose in durability we gain in reproduction, and so once more I repeat, let who will be statesman, warrior, stock jobber, or voluptuary, but give me the palette and the easel, the underscore deliridon pantra underscore, the line of beauty and the brush. Can you wonder that I should wish my boy to tread the same path? Had I but begun at his age, and worked as I underscore should underscore have worked, what might I have been now? Could I but make amends to him by leading him up the path to real fame, and see Vere the regenerator of modern art, I should die happy. And now, Hal, I must ask you of your own pursuits and your own successes. I do not often see an English paper, but these are a fine sporting people, with a dash of our English tastes and love of horseflesh, and in a small pothouse where we put up last week, in the very heart of the Bonnot, I found a print of Flying Childers, and a _Bell's Life_ of the month before last. In this I read that your Marigold colt was first favorite for the Derby, and I can only say that I hope he will win, as fervently as I should have done some years back, when he would have carried a large portion of my money, or at least of my credit, on his back. I have also gathered that your Shorthorns won the prize at the Great Cattle Show. Who drives fat oxen must himself be fat. I trust, therefore, that you are flourishing and thriving, also, that Constance, the most stately little lady I ever beheld at 2 years old, still queens it at the manor house. I will write again shortly, but must leave off now, as my boy is calling me to go out. He grows more like his poor mother every day, especially about the eyes. Adieu, Hal, ever yours. Philip Edgerton. Letter 2. The longer I linger here the more I become wedded to the land in which, after all, I have known the few hours of real happiness I ever spent. Yes, Hal, with all its guilt, with all its anxieties, with everything and everybody battling against me, that was my golden year, such as I shall never see again. She was so generous, so gentle, and so true, she sacrificed all so willingly for me, and never looked back. Such courage, such patience, and oh! Such beauty, and to lose her after one short year. Well, it is my punishment, and I bear it, but if it had to be done again I would do it. Surely I was not so much to blame. Had she but lived I would have made her such amends. And after all she is mine in her lonely grave under the acacias, and I shall meet her again. If the universe holds her I shall meet her again. Wearily the years have dragged on since I lost her, but every birthday is a milestone nearer home, and in the meantime I have Vera and my art. And we wander about this wild country, and scamper across its boundless plains, and I paint and smoke, and try to be happy. We arrived here last night, and I need scarcely tell you that Adeldorf is as English as any place out of England can be, and my old friend but little altered during the last 20 years. You remember de Rohan at Melton and Newmarket, at Rome and at Paris. Wherever he lived he was quite the Englishman, and always rode a thoroughbred horse. It would indeed be ungrateful on your part to forget him. Need I remind you of the dinner at the old club, and the procession afterwards, with some 14 wax candles, to inspect the switcher in your stables, at the risk of burning down the greater part of the town, and converting some of the best horses in England into an exceedingly tough grill? I can see the Count's face of drunken gravity now, as he felt carefully down the horse's forelegs, undeterred by the respectful stare of your groom, or the undisguised astonishment of the animal itself. "That is his name?" was the only question he asked of the polite Mr. Topthorne. "The switcher, my lord," was the reply. "Very nice name," said the Count, and bought him forthwith at a price that you yourself can best appreciate, but from that day to this he never could pronounce the animal's appellation, and although he rode this fish-hare both in England and here, and has got prints and pictures of him all over the house, this fish-hare he will continue to be till the end of time. All this Anglomania, however, is not much appreciated in high places, and I can see enough without looking much below the surface to satisfy me that the Count is eyed jealously by the authorities, and that if ever they catch him tripping they will not spare his fortunes or his person. I fear there will be a row before long, and I would not trust the wild blood of my friends here if once they get the upper hand. Only yesterday an incident occurred that gave me a pretty correct idea of the state of feeling in this country, and the disaffection of the peasant to his imperial rulers. Vera and I were traveling along in our usual manner, occupying the front seat of a most dilapidated carriage, which I purchased at Bucharest for 20 ducats, with the nurse and the baggage behind. We had stopped for me to sketch an animated group, in the shape of a drove of wild horses being drafted and chosen by their respective owners, and Vera was clapping his hands and shouting with delight at the hurry-scurry of the scene. "By the way, there was a white horse that I caught in a beautiful attitude, who comes out admirably and lights up the whole sketch," when an officer and a couple of Austrian dragoons rode into the midst of the busy horse tamers, and very rudely proceeded to subject them to certain inquiries, which seemed to meet with sulky and evasive answers enough. After a time the Austrian officer, a handsome boy of 20, stroking an incipient mustache, ordered the oldest man of the party to be pinioned, and placing him between his two soldiers, began to interrogate him in a most offensive and supercilious manner. The old man, who was what we should call in England a better sort of yeoman farmer, of course immediately affected utter ignorance of German, and as the young Austrian was no great proficient in Hungarian, I was compelled most unwillingly to interpret between them, Vera looking on meanwhile with his mouth wide open, in a state of intense bewilderment. The following is a specimen of the conversation, dash. _ Austrian sublieutenant _ in German thou hast been hiding deserters, and so shalt thou be imprisoned, and fined, and suffer punishment. I have to modify these threats into Hungarian. Brother, this noble officer seeks a deserter. Knowest thou of such an one? _ old man _ my father, I know nothing. _ Austrian officer _ with many expletives, modified as before by your humble servant you shall be punished with the utmost rigor if you do not give him up. _ old man _ again my father, I know nothing. _ officer _ losing all patience, and gesticulating wildly with his sword slave, brute, dog, tell me this instant which way he took, or I will have you hanged to that nearest tree, your family shall be imprisoned, and your village burnt to the ground. _ old man _ as before my father, I know nothing. The case was getting hopeless, but the young officer had now thoroughly lost his temper, and ordered his man to tie the peasant up, and flog him soundly with a stirrup leather. Here I thought it high time to interpose. I saw the wild Hungarian blood beginning to boil in the veins of some dozen dark scowling fellows, who had been occupied tending the horses. Eyes were flashing at the Austrians, and hands clutching under the sheepskin where the long knife lies. Fortunately the officer was a gentleman and an admirer of the English. With much difficulty I persuaded him to abandon his cruel intention, and to ride on in prosecution of his search, but it was when his back was turned that the tide of indignation against himself and his country swelled to the highest. The peasants' faces actually became convulsed with rage, their voices shook with fury, and threats and maledictions were poured on their masters enough to make one's very blood run cold. If ever they do get the upper hand, woe to the oppressor. There is nothing on earth so fearful as a Jacquerie. God forbid this fair land should ever see one. We journeyed on in a different direction from the dragoons, but we caught occasional glimpses of their white coats as they gleamed through the acacias that skirted the road, and I was just thinking how well I could put them in with a dab or two of chalk against a thunderstorm, or a dark wood in the midst of summer, when the bright sun makes the foliage almost black, and debating in my own mind whether the officer would not have made a better sketch if his horse had been a light gray, when my postillion pulled up with a jerk that nearly chucked Veer out of the carriage, and, pointing to something in the road, assured my excellency that the horse was dying, and the rider, in all probability, lying killed under his beast. Sure enough, an overridden horse was prostrate in the middle of the road, and a young man vainly endeavoring to raise him by the bridle, and calling him by all the terms of endearment and abuse in the Hungarian vocabulary, without the slightest effect. Seeing our carriage, he addressed me in German, and with a gentlemanlike voice and manner begged to know in what direction I was traveling. I hope to get to Edeldorf tonight, was my answer. He started at the name. Edeldorf, said he, I, too, am bound for Edeldorf, can you favor me with a seat in your carriage? Of course I immediately complied, and Veer and I soon had the stranger between us, journeying amicably on towards my old friend's chateau. You know my failing, Hal, so I need not tell you how it was that I immediately began to study my new acquaintance's physiognomy, somewhat, I thought, to his discomfiture, for at first he turned his head away, but after a while seemed to think better of it, and entered into conversation with much frankness and vivacity. The sun was getting low, and I think I could have sketched him very satisfactorily in that warm, soft light. His head was essentially that of a soldier, the brow deficient in ideality, but with the bold outlines which betoken penetration and forethought. Constructiveness fully developed, combativeness moderate, but firmness very strongly marked, the eye deep set, and, though small, remarkably brilliant, the jaw that of a strong, bold man, while the lines about the mouth showed great energy of character and decision. From the general conformation of his head I should have placed forethought as the distinguishing quality of his character, and I should have painted the rich brown tones of his complexion on a system of my own, which such a portrait would be admirably calculated to bring out. However, I could not well ask him to sit to me upon so short an acquaintance, so, while he and Veer chatted on, for they soon became great friends, and my new acquaintance seemed charmed to find a child speaking German so fluently, I began to speculate on the trait and character of this mysterious addition to our party. Hair cut short, mustache close clipped, thought I, perfect German accent, and the broad Viennese dialect of the aristocracy, all this looks like a soldier, but the rough frieze coat, and huge shapeless riding boots could never belong to an officer of that neatest of armies, the imperial and kingly. Then his muscular figure, and light active gait, which I remarked as he sprang into the carriage, would argue him one who was in the habit of practicing feats of strength and agility. There is no mistaking the effects of the gymnasium. Stay, I have it, he is a fencing master, that accounts for the military appearance, the quick glance, the somewhat worn look of the countenance, and he is going to Adeldorf, to teach the raw Hans boy the polite art of self-defense. So much the better. I, too, love dearly a turn with the foils, so I can have a glorious set to with him tomorrow or the next day, and then, when we are more intimate, I can paint him. I think I shall do him in oils. I wish he would turn his head the least thing further this way. I had got as far as this when my new friend did indeed turn his head round, and looking me full in the face, thus addressed me, "Sir, you are an Englishman, and an honorable man. I have no right to deceive you. You incur great danger by being seen with me. I have no right to implicate you, set me down, and let me walk." Veer looked more astonished than ever. I begged him to explain himself. "I tell you," said he, "that I am a thief and a deserter. My name is posted at every barrack gate in the empire. I am liable to be hanged, if taken. Are you not afraid of me now?" "No," exclaimed Veer, his color heightening and his eyes glistening, "oh, so like her. Papa and I will take care of you, don't be afraid." My boy had anticipated what I was going to say, but I assured him that as I had taken him into my carriage I considered him as my guest, and come what would I never could think of abandoning him till we reached our destination. "Of course," I added, "you are then free to come and go as you please. If you have done anything disgraceful, we need never know each other again. I do not wish to hear of it. You are to me only a belated traveler, permit me to add, a gentleman, to whom I am delighted to be of service. Will you smoke? Let me offer you a cigar." The blood rushed to his face as he declined the proffered courtesy. For an instant he looked half offended, and then, seizing my hand, he exclaimed, "If you knew all, you would pity me, nay, more, you would approve of what I have done." He turned suddenly to Veer, and rather startled him by abruptly exclaiming, "Boy, do you love your father? Is he all the world to you?" "Yes," said Veer, coloring up again, "of course I love Papa, and Nurse Nettich too." That worthy woman was fast asleep in the rumble. "Well," said the stranger, more composedly, "I love my father, too, he is all I have in the world, and for his sake I would do the same thing again. I will tell you all about it, and you shall judge between me and my crime. But my new friend's story I must defer, my dear Hal, to another letter. So for the present, Chapter 2. The Deserter. Dim and strange are the recollections that steal over me while I read these time-worn letters of one who, with all his faults, was the kindest, fondest, and best of enthusiasts. It seems like a dream, I cannot fancy that I am the child alluded to. It seems as though all this must have happened to someone else, and that I stood by and watched. Yet have I a vague and shadowy remembrance of the warm autumnal evening, the road soft and thick with dust, the creaking, monotonous motion of the carriage, and my waking up from an occasional nap, and finding myself propped by the strong arm of a stranger, and nestling my head upon his broad shoulder, whilst my father's kind face and eager eyes were turned towards my new acquaintance with the earnest comprehensive look I remember so well. My father always seemed to take in at a glance, not only the object that attracted his attention, but all its accessories, possible as well as actual. I believe he never left off painting in his mind. I remember nothing very distinctly, and no wonder, for my little brain must have been a strange chaos of shifting scenes and unexpected events, foreign manners and home ideas, to say nothing of a general confusion of tongues, for I could prattle French, German, and Hungarian, with a smattering of Turkish, not to mention my own native language, and I use them all indiscriminately. But my father's letters bring back much that I had otherwise forgotten, and whilst I read the story of the renegade, I can almost fancy I am leaning against his upright soldier-like form, and listening to the clear decided tones in which he told his tale. Letter 3. "I am a soldier, sir," said my new acquaintance, whilst I leant back in the carriage smoking my cigar, and, Hal, made the most of my study. "I am an Austrian soldier, at least I was a week ago. I would not give much for my chance if ever I come into the clutches of the Double Eagle again. Shall I tell you why I enter the Imperial Army? All my life I have thought it best to be on the winning side. If I had been born an Englishman, oh, what happiness! I would have asked no better lot than to wander about with my dog and my gun, and be free. But a Croat, no, there is no liberty in Croatia. We must have masters, forsooth. Territorial dues and seigneurial rights, and we must bow and cringe and be trampled on by our own nobility. But these, too, have masters, and I have seen the lord of many thousand acres tremble before a captain of dragoons. So I determined that if a military despotism was to be the order of the day, why I, too, would make a part of the great engine. Perhaps sometime I might come to wield it all. My father was appointed steward to a great lord in Hungary. Perhaps, had he remained, I might never have left home, for I am his only child, and we two are alone in the world. Besides, is not a son's first duty to obey his father? But I could not bear to exchange the free open air, and my horse, and my gun, and my dogs. I had the best greyhounds in Croatia, for a leathern stool and an inkstand, and I said, "Father, I too will become an Austrian, and so some day shall I be a great man, perhaps a colonel, and then will I return once a year to see you, and comfort you in your old age." So I was sworn to obey the emperor, and soon I learnt my exercise, and saw that to rise even in the Austrian army was not difficult for one who could see clearly before him, and could count that 2 and 2 make 4, and never 5. Very few men are soldiers at heart, and those who love the profession and would fain shine, can only see one way to success, and that must be the old established track that has always been followed. If I wanted to move across that stream and had no boats, what should I do? I would try if it be too deep to wade. But the regulation says, soldiers shall not wade if the water be over a certain depth. So for 6 inches of water I must be defeated. That should not be my way. If it came no higher than their chins my men should cross, and if we could keep our muskets dry, where would be the harm? Well, I soon rose to be a corporal and a sergeant, and whilst I practiced fencing and riding and gymnastics, I learnt besides something of gunnery and fortification, and the art of supplying an army with food. At last I was made lieutenant and paymaster of the regiment, for I could always calculate readily, and never shrank from trouble or feared responsibility. So I had good pay and good comrades, and was getting on. Meanwhile my poor father was distressing himself about my profession, and imagining all sorts of misfortunes that would happen to me if I remained a soldier. In his letters to me he always hinted at the possibility of some great success at his hopes of, before long, placing me in an independent position, that I should leave the army to come and live with him, and we would farm an estate of our own, and never be parted any more. Poor old man! What do you think he built on? Why, these foolish lotteries! Ticket after ticket did he purchase, and ticket after ticket came up a blank. At last, in his infatuation, he raised a sum of money enough to obtain him all the numbers he had set his heart upon, for he mixed calculation with his gambling, which is certain ruin, and for this purpose he embezzled 2,000 florins of his employer's property, and wasted it as he had done the rest. In his despair he wrote to me. What could I do? 2,000 florins were in the pay chest. I have it here in this leathern bag. I have saved my father. He is steward at Adeldorf. I shall see him tonight. After that I must fly the country. I will go to England, the land of the free. I am ruined, degraded, and my life is not worth 12 hours' purchase, but I do not regret it. Look at your boy, sir, and tell me if I am not right. He is a fine fellow this, Hal, depend upon it, and though my own feelings as a gentleman were a little shocked at a man talking thus coolly of robbery in anything but the legitimate way on the turf, I could scarcely remonstrate with him now the thing was done, so I shook him by the hand, and promised him at any rate a safe convoy to Adeldorf, which we were now rapidly approaching. You like a fine place, Hal, you always did. I remember when you used to vow that if ever fortune smiled upon you in faith, it is not for want of wooing that you have missed the goddess's favors, how you would build and castellate and improve Beverly Manor, till, in my opinion as an artist and a man of associations, you would spoil it completely. But I think even your fastidious taste would be delighted with Adeldorf. The sun was just down as we drove into the park, and returned the salute of the smart hussar mounting guard at the lodge, and the winding road, and smooth sward dotted with thorns, and those eternal acacias, reminded one of a gentleman's place in old England, till we rounded the corner of a beautifully dressed flower garden, and came in view of the castle itself, with all its angles and turrets and embrasures, and mullioned windows, and picturesque ins and outs. The whole standing boldly out in a chiaro oscuro against the evening sky, fast beginning to soften into twilight. Old de Rohan was on the steps to welcome me, his figure upright and noble as ever, his countenance as pleasing, but the beard and mustache that you and I remember so dark and glossy, now as white as snow, yet he is a very handsome fellow still. In mail or plate, leaning his arm on his helmet, with his beard flowing over a steel cuirass inlaid with gold, he would make a capital seneschal, or marshal of a tournament, or other elderly dignitary of the Middle Ages, but I should like best to paint him in dark velvet, with a skullcap, as Lord Soulis, or some other noble votary of the magic art, and to bring him out in a dusky room, with one ray of vivid light from a lamp just over his temples, and gleaming off that fine, bold, shining forehead, from which the hair is now completely worn away. There are no more of the old dusty letters. Why these should have been tied up and preserved for so many years is more than I can tell. They have, however, reminded me of much in my youth that I had well nigh forgotten. I must try back on my vague memories for the commencement of my narrative. Chapter 3. Parnobile. You shall play with my toys, and break them if you like, for my papa loves the English, and you are my English friend, said a handsome blue-eyed child to his little companion, as they sauntered hand in hand through the spacious entrance hall at Edeldorf. The boy was evidently bent on patronizing his friend. The friend was somewhat abashed and bewildered, and grateful to be taken notice of. What is your name? May I call you by your Christian name? Said the lesser child, timidly, and rather nestling to his protector, for such had the bigger boy constituted himself. My name is Victor, was the proud reply, and __ may call me Victor, because I love you, but the servants must call me Count, because my papa is a Count, and I am not an Austrian Count, but a Hungarian. Come and see my sword. So the two children were soon busy in an examination of that very beautiful, but not very destructive plaything. They were indeed a strange contrast. Victor the Rohan, son and heir to one of the noblest and wealthiest of Hungary's aristocracy, looked all over the high-bred child he was. Free and bold, his large, frank blue eyes, and wide brow, shaded with clustering curls of golden brown, betokened a gallant, thoughtless spirit, and a kind, warm heart, whilst the delicate nostril and handsomely curved mouth of the well-born child betrayed, perhaps, a little too much pride for one so young, and argued a disposition not too patient of contradiction or restraint. His little companion was as unlike him as possible, and indeed most people would have taken Victor for the English boy, and Veer for the foreign one. The latter was heavy, awkward, and ungainly in his movements, timid and hesitating in his manner, with a sallow complexion, and dark, deep-set eyes, that seemed always looking into a world beyond. He was a strange child, totally without the light-heartedness of his age, timid, shy, and awkward, but capable of strong attachments, and willing to endure anything for the sake of those he loved. Then he had quaint fancies, and curious modes of expressing them, which made other children laugh at him, when the boy would retire into himself, deeply wounded and unhappy, but too proud to show it. As he looks now at Victor's sword, with which the latter is vaporing about the hall, destroying imaginary enemies, Veer asks. What becomes of the people that are killed, Victor? We ride over their bodies, says Victor, who has just delivered a finishing thrust at his phantom foe. Yes, but what _becomes_ of them? Pursues the child, now answering himself. I think they come to me in my dreams, for sometimes, do you know, I dream of men in armor charging on white horses, and they come by with a wind that wakes me, and when I ask Nedich who they are, she says they are the fairies, but I don't think they are fairies, because you know fairies are quite small, and have wings. No, I think they must be the people that are killed. Very likely, replies Victor, who has not considered the subject in this light, and whose dreams are mostly of ponies and plum cake very likely, but come to Papa, and he will give us some grapes. So off they go, arm in arm, to the great banqueting hall, and Veer postpones his dream theories to some future occasion, for there is a charm about grapes that speaks at once to a child's heart. So the two boys make their entrance into the banqueting hall, where de Rohan sits in state, surrounded by his guests. On his right is placed Philip Edgerton, whose dark eye gleams with pleasure as he looks upon his son. Who but a father would take delight in such a plain, unattractive child? Veer glides quietly to his side, shrinking from the strange faces and gorgeous uniforms around, but Victor walks boldly up to the old count, and demands his daily glass of Tokay, not as a favor, but a right. I drink to Hungary, says the child, looking full into the face of his next neighbor, a prince allied to the imperial family, and a general of Austrian cavalry. Monsieur le Prince, your good health. Come, clink your glass with me. Your boy is a true de Rohan, says the good-natured Austrian, as he accepts the urchin's challenge, and their goblets ring against each other. Will you be a soldier, my lad, and wear the white uniform? I will be a soldier, answers the child, but not an Austrian soldier like you. Austrian soldiers are not so brave as Hungarians. Well said, my little patriot, replies the amused general. So you do not think our people are good for much? Why, with that sword of yours, I should be very sorry to face you with my whole division. What a light dragoon the rogue will make, de Rohan. See, he has plundered the grapes already. And the jolly prince sat back in his chair, and poured himself out another glass of imperial Tokay. Hush, Victor, said his father, laughing, in spite of himself, at his child's forwardness. Look at your little English friend, he stands quiet there, and says nothing. I shall make an Englishman of my boy, Edgerton, He shall go to an English school, and learn to ride and box, and to be a man. I love England and the English. Edgerton, your good health. I wish my boy to be like yours. _ Sapperman exclamation mark _ He is quiet, but I will answer for it he fears neither man nor devil. My father's face lighted up with pleasure as he pressed me to his side. Kind father. I believe he thought his ugly, timid, shrinking child was the admiration of all. I think the boy has courage, he said, but for that I give him little credit. All men are naturally brave, it is but education that makes us reflect, hence we learn to fear consequences, and so become cowards. Pardon, _Monsieur_, observed the Austrian general, with a laugh. Now, my opinion is that all men are naturally cowards, and that we alone deserve credit who overcome that propensity, and so distinguish ourselves for what we choose to call bravery, but which we ought rather to term self-command. What say you, de Rohan? You have been in action, and on the ground, too, more than once. Were you not cursedly afraid? De Rohan smiled good-humoredly, and filled his glass. Shall I tell you my opinion of courage? Said he, holding up the sparkling fluid to the light. I think of courage what our Hungarian hussars think of a breastplate. Of what use, say they, is cuirass and backpiece and all that weight of defensive armor? Give us a pint of wine in our stomachs, and we are _breastplate all over _. Come, Wallenstein, put your breastplate on, it is very light, and fits very easily. The general filled again, but returned to the charge. You remind me, said he, of a conversation I overheard when I was a lieutenant in the 1st Regiment of Uhlans. We were drawn up on the crest of a hill opposite a battery in position not half a mile from us. If they had retired us 200 yards, we should have been under cover, but we never got the order, and there we stood. Whish! The round shot came over our heads and under our feet, and into our ranks, and we lost 2 men and 5 horses before we knew where we were. The soldiers grumbled sadly, and a few seemed inclined to turn rein and go to the rear. Mind you, it is not fair to ask cavalry to sit still and be pounded for amusement, but the officers being _cowards by education _Mr. Edgerton, did their duty well, and kept the men together. I was watching my troop anxiously enough, and I heard one man say to his comrade, look at Johann, Fritz. What a bold one he is, he thinks nothing of the fire, see, he tickles the horse of his front rank man even now, to make him kick. Exactly my argument, interrupted my father. He was an uneducated man, consequently saw nothing to be afraid of. Bravery, after all, is only insensibility to danger. Fritz did not think so, replied Wallenstein. Hear his answer, Johann is a blockhead, he replied, he has never been under fire before, and does not know his danger, but you and I, old comrade, we deserve to be made corporals, for we sit quiet here on our horses, though we are most cursedly afraid _. The guests all laughed, and the discussion would have terminated, but that de Rohan, who had drunk more wine than was his custom, and who was very proud of his boy, could not refrain from once more turning the conversation to Victor's merits, and to that personal courage by which, however much he might affect to make light of it in society, he set such store. Well, Wallenstein, said he, you hold that nature makes us cowards, if so, my boy here ought to show something of the white feather. Come hither, Victor. Are you afraid of being in the dark? No, Papa. Answered Victor, boldly, but added, after a moment's consideration, except in a ghost's gallery. I don't go through the ghost's gallery after 6 o'clock. This naive confession excited much amusement amongst the guests, but de Rohan's confidence in his boy's courage was not to be so shaken. What shall I give you, said he, to go and fetch me the old breviary that lies on the table at the far end of the ghost's gallery? Victor looked at me, and eyed him. My breath came quicker and quicker. The child colored painfully, but did not answer. I felt his terrors myself. I looked upon the proposed expedition as a soldier might on a forlorn hope, but something within kept stirring me to speak. It was a mingled feeling of emulation, pity, and friendship, tinged with that inexplicable charm that coming danger has always possessed for me, a charm that the constitutionally brave are incapable of feeling. I mastered my shyness with an effort, and, shaking all over, said to the master of the house, in a thick, low voice. If you please, Monsieur Lecomte, if Victor goes, I will go too. Well said, little man. Bravo, boy. Vere, you're a trump. In plain English from my father, and in heaven's name, give the lads a breastplate apiece, in the shape of a glass of Tokay. From the jolly general, were the acclamations that greeted my resolution, and for one delicious moment I felt like a little hero. Victor, too, caught the enthusiasm, and, ashamed of showing less courage than his playfellow, expressed his readiness to accompany me, first stipulating, however, with praiseworthy caution, that he should take his sword for our joint preservation, and also that two large bunches of grapes should be placed at our disposal on our safe return, if, as Victor touchingly remarked, we ever came back at all. My father opened the door for us with a low bow, and it closed upon a burst of laughter, which to us, bound, as we fancied, on an expedition of unparalleled danger, sounded to the last degree unfeeling. Hand in hand we two children walked through the anteroom, and across the hall, nor was it until we reached the first landing on the wide, gloomy oak staircase, that we paused to consider our future plans, and to scan the desperate nature of our enterprise. There were but two more flights of steps, a green baize door to go through, a few yards of passage to traverse, and then, Victor assured me, in trembling accents, we should be in the ghost's gallery. My heart beat painfully, and my informant began to cry. We laid our plans, however, with considerable caution, and made a solemn compact of alliance, offensive and defensive, that no power, natural or supernatural, was to shake. We were on no account whatsoever to leave go of each other's hands. Thus linked, and Victor having his sword drawn, for the furtherance of which warlike attitude I was to keep carefully on his left, we resolved to advance, if possible, talking the whole way up to the fatal table whereon lay the breviary, and then snatching it up hastily, to return backwards, so as to present our front to the foe till we reached the green baize door, at which point _soft_keep_out_ was to be the order, and we were to rush back into the dining room as fast as our legs could carry us. But in the event of our progress being interrupted by the ghost, who appeared, as Victor informed me, in the shape of a huge black dog with green eyes, a description at which my blood ran cold, and which he added had been seen once by his governess and twice by an old drunken hussar who waited on him, and answered to the name of Hans, we were to lie down on our faces, so as to hide our eyes from the ghostly vision, and scream till we alarmed the house, but on no account, we repeated in the most binding and solemn manner, on no account were we to let go of each other's hands. This compact made and provided, we advanced towards the gallery, Victor feeling the edge and point of his weapon with an appearance of confidence that my own beating heart told me must be put on for the occasion, and would vanish at the first appearance of danger. And now the green door is passed and we are in the gallery. A faint light through the stained windows only serves to show its extent and general gloom, whilst its corners and abutments are black as a wolf's mouth. Not a servant in the castle would willingly traverse this gallery after dark, and we two children feel that we are at last alone, and cut off from all hopes of assistance or rescue. But the breviary lies on the table at the far end, and, dreading the very sound of our own footsteps, we steal quietly on. All at once Victor stops short. "What is that?" says he, in trembling accents. The question alone takes away my breath, and I feel the drops break out on my lips and forehead. We stop simultaneously and listen. Encouraged by the silence, we creep on, and for an instant I experience that vague tumultuous feeling of excitement which is almost akin to pleasure. But hark! A heavy breath. A groan. My hair stands on end, and Victor's hand clasps mine like a vice. I dare scarce turn my head towards the sound, it comes from that far corner. There it is. A dark object in the deepest gloom of that recess seems crouching for a spring. The ghost. The ghost. I exclaim, losing all power of self-command in an agony of fear. The dog. The dog. Shrieks Victor, and away we scour hard as our legs can carry us, forgetful of our solemn agreements and high resolves, forgetful of all but that safety lies before, and terror of the ghastliest description behind. Away we scour, Victor leaving his sword where he dropped it at the first alarm, through the green door, down the oak staircase, across the hall, nor stop till we reached the banqueting room, with its reassuring faces and its lights, cheering beyond measure by contrast with the gloom from which we have escaped. What shouts of laughter met us as we approached the table. "Well, Victor, where's the breviary?" said the Count. "What? My boy, was nature too strong for you in the dark, with nobody looking on?" asked the general. "See. He has lost his sword," laughed another. "And the little Englander, he, too, was panic-struck," remarked the fourth. I shrank from them all and took refuge at my father's side. "Vere, I am ashamed of you," was all he said, but the words sank deep into my heart, and I bowed my head with a feeling of burning shame, that I have disgraced myself in my father's eyes forever. We were sent to bed, and I shared Victor's nursery, under the joint charge of Netich and his own attendant, but, do what I would, I could not sleep. There was a stain upon my character in the eyes of the one I loved best on earth, and I could not bear it. Though so quiet and undemonstrative, I was a child of strong attachments. I perfectly idolized my father, and now he was ashamed of me. The words seemed to burn in my little heart. I tossed and tumbled and fretted myself into a fever, aggravated by the sounding snores of Netich and the other nurse, who slept as only nurses can. At last I could bear it no longer. I sat up in bed and peered stealthily round. All were hushed in sleep. I determined to do or die. Yes, I would go to the gallery, I would fetch the breviary and lay it on my father's table before he awoke. If I succeeded, I should recover his good opinion. If I encountered the phantom dog, why, he could but kill me, after all. I would wake Victor, and we would go together, or, no, I would take the whole peril, and have all the glory of the exploit, myself. I thought it over every way. At last my mind was made up, my naked feet were on the floor, I stole from the nursery, I threaded the dark passages, I reached the gallery, a dim light was shining at the far end, and I could hear earnest voices conversing in a low, guarded tone. Half frightened and altogether confused, I stopped and listened. Chapter 4. Father and Son. The Count's old steward has seen all go to rest in the castle, the lords have left the banqueting room, and the servants, who have been making merry in the hall, are long ere this sound asleep. It is the steward's custom to see all safe before he lights his lamp and retires to rest, but tonight he shades it carefully with a wrinkled hand that trembles strangely, and his white face peers into the darkness, as though he were about some deed of shame. He steals into the ghost's gallery, and creeps silently to the farther end. There is a dark object muffled in a cloak in the gloomiest corner, and the light from the steward's lamp reveals a fine young man, sleeping with that thorough abandonment which is only observable in those who are completely outwearied and overdone. It is some minutes ere the old man can wake him. "My boy," says he, "my boy, it is time for us to part. Hard, hard is it to be robbed of my son robbed," and the old man checks himself as though the word recalled some painful associations. "Eh, father," was the reply, "you know our old Croatian proverb, he who steals is but a borrower. Nevertheless, I do not wish the Austrians to borrow me, in case I should never be returned, and it is unmannerly for the lieutenant to occupy the same quarters as the general. I must be off before dawn, but surely it cannot be midnight yet. In less than an hour the day will break, my son. I have concealed you here because not a servant of the household dare set foot in the ghost's gallery till daylight, and you are safe, but 24 more hours must see you on the Danube, and you must come here no more. Oh, my boy! My boy! Lost to save me! Dishonored that I might not be disgraced! My boy! My boy!" And the old man burst into a passion of weeping that seemed to convulse his very frame with agony. The son had more energy and self-command. His voice did not even shake as he soothed and quieted the old man with a protecting fondness like that of a parent for a child. "My father," said he, "there is no dishonor where there is no guilt. My first duty is to you, and were it to do again, I would do it." "What?" "It was but a momentary qualm and a snatch at the box, and _now_ you are safe. Father, I shall come back some day, and offer you a home. Fear not for me. I have it _here_ on my breast, the stuff of which men make fortunes. I can rely upon myself. I can obey orders, and, father, when others are bewildered and confused, I can command. I feel it, I know it. Let me but get clear of the eagle's talons, and fear not for me, dear father, I shall see you again, and we will be prosperous and happy yet. But, how to get away? Have you thought of a plan? Can I get a good horse here? Does the Count know I am in trouble, and will he help me? Tell me all, father, and I shall see my own way, I will answer for it." "My gallant boy," said the steward, despite of himself moved to admiration by the self-reliant bearing of his son, "there is but one chance, for the Count could not but hand you over to Wallenstein if he knew you were in the castle, and that it would be a pleasant jest, and the nearest tree. The general is a jovial comrade and a good-humored acquaintance, but, as a matter of duty, he would hang his own son and go to dinner afterwards with an appetite none the worse. No, no. Trust to an Austrian's mercy and confess yourself. I have a better plan than that. The Zingines are in the village, they held their merrymaking here yesterday. I saw their queen last night after you arrived. I have arranged it all with her. A gypsy's dress, a dyed skin, and the middle of the troop, not an Austrian soldier in Hungary that will detect you then. Banishment is better than death. Oh, my boy! My boy!" And once more the old man gave way and wept. "Forward, then, father," said the young man, whom I now recognized as my traveling acquaintance, "there is no time to lose now. How can we get out of the castle without alarming the household? I leave all to you now, it will be my turn someday. And as he spoke he rose from the steps on which he had been lying when his recumbent form had so alarmed Victor and myself, and accompanied his father down a winding staircase that seemed let into the massive wall of the old building. My curiosity was fearfully excited. I would have given all my playthings to follow them. I crept stealthily on, naked feet and all, but I was not close enough behind, and the door shut quietly with a spring just as my hand was upon it, leaving me alone in the ghost's gallery. I was not the least frightened now. I forgot all about ghosts and breviaries, and stole back to my nursery and my bed, my little head completely filled with a medley of stewards and soldiers and gypsies, and Austrian generals and military executions, and phantom dogs and secret staircases, and all the most unlikely incidents that crowd together in that busy organ a child's brain. Chapter 5. The Zanginese. The morning sun smiles upon a motley troop journeying towards the Danube. Two or three lithe, supple urchins, bounding and dancing along with half-naked bodies, and bright black eyes shining through knotted elf locks, form the advanced guard. Half a dozen donkeys seem to carry the whole property of the tribe. The main body consists of sinewy, active-looking men, and strikingly handsome girls, all walking with a free, graceful air and elastic gait peculiar to those whose lives are passed entirely in active exercise, under no roof but that of heaven. Dark-browed women in the very meridian of beauty bring up the rear, dragging or carrying a race of swarthy progeny, all alike distinguished for the sparkling eyes and raven hair, which, with the cunning nothing can overreach, and a nature nothing can tame, seem to be the peculiar inheritance of the gypsy. Their costume is striking, not to say grotesque. Some of the girls, and all the matrons, bind their brows with various colored handkerchiefs, which form a very picturesque and not unbecoming headgear, whilst in a few instances coins even of gold are strung amongst the jetty locks of the Zingini beauties. The men are not so particular in their attire. One sinewy fellow wears only a goatskin shirt and a string of beads round his neck, but the generality are clad in the coarse cloth of the country, much tattered, and bearing evident symptoms of weather and wear. The little mischievous urchins who are clinging round their mothers' necks, or dragging back from their mothers' hands, and holding on to their mothers' skirts, are almost naked. Small heads and hands and feet, all the marks of what we are accustomed to term high birth, are hereditary among the gypsies, and we doubt if the Queen of the South herself was a more queenly-looking personage than the dame now marching in the midst of the throng, and conversing earnestly with her companion, a resolute-looking man scarce centering upon the prime of life, with a gypsy complexion, but a bearing in which it is not difficult to recognize the soldier. He is talking to his protectress for such she is with a military frankness and vivacity, which even to that royal personage, accustomed though she be to exact all the respect due to her rank, appear by no means displeasing. The lady is verging on the autumn of her charms, their summer must have been scorching indeed, and though a masculine beauty, is a beauty nevertheless. Black-browed is she, and deep-colored, with eyes of fire, and locks of jet, even now untinged with gray. Straight and regular are her features, and the wide mouth, with its strong, even dazzling teeth, betokens an energy and force of will which would do credit to the other sex. She has the face of a woman that would dare much, labor much, everything but underscore love underscore much. She ought to be a queen, and she is one, none the less despotic for ruling over a tribe of gypsies instead of a civilized community. None dispute my word here, says she, and my word is pledged to bring you to the Danube. Let me see a soldier of them all lay a hand upon you, and you shall see the gypsy brood show their teeth. A long knife is no bad weapon at close quarters. When you have got to the top of the wheel you will remember me. The soldier laughed, and lightly replied, yours are the sort of eyes one does not easily forget, mother. I wish I were a prince of the blood in your nation. As I am situated now I can only be dazzled by so much beauty, and go my ways. The woman checked him sternly, almost savagely, though a few minutes before she had been listening, half amused, to his gay and not very respectful conversation. Hush! She said, trifler. Once more I say, when the wheel has turned, remember me. Give me your hand, I can read it plainer so. What, mother? Laughed out her companion. Every gypsy can tell fortunes, mine has been told many a time, but it never came true. She was studying the lines on his palm with earnest attention. She raised her dark eyes angrily to his face. Blind. Blind. She answered, in a low, eager tone. The best of you cannot see a yard upon your way. Look at that white road, winding and winding many a mile before us upon the plain. Because it is flat and soft and smooth as far as we can see, will there be no hills on our journey, no rocks to cut our feet, no thorns to tear our limbs? Can you see the Danube rolling on far, far before us? Can you see the river you will have to cross someday, or can you tell me where it leads? I have the map of our journey here in my brain, I have the map of your career here on your hand. Once more I say, when the chiefs are in council, and the hosts are melting like snow before the sun, and the earth quakes, and the heavens are filled with thunder, and the shower that falls scorches and crushes and blasts, remember me. I follow the line of wealth, man of gold. Spoil on, here a horse, there a diamond, hundreds to uphold the right, thousands to spare the wrong, both hands full, and broad lands near a city of palaces, and a king's favor, and a nation of slaves beneath thy foot. I follow the line of pleasure, costly amber, rich embroidery, dark eyes melting for the Croat, glances unveiled for the shaven head, many and loving and beautiful, a garland of roses, all for one rose by a rose plucked and withered and thrown away, one tender bud remaining, cherish it till it blows, and wear it till it dies. I follow the line of blood, it leads towards the rising sun charging squadrons with lances in rest, and a wild shout in a strange tongue, and the dead wrapped in grey, with charm and amulet that were powerless to save, and hosts of many nations gathered by the sea pestilence, famine, despair, and victory. Rising on the whirlwind, chief among chiefs, the honored of leaders, the counselor of princes, remember me. But ha! The line is crossed. Beware! Trust not the sons of the adopted land, when the lily is on thy breast, beware of the dusky shadow on the wall, beware and remember me. The gypsy stopped, and clung to him exhausted. For a few paces she was unable to support herself, the prophetic mood passed, there was a reaction, and all her powers seemed to fail her at once, but her companion walked on in silence. The eagerness of the Pythoness had impressed even his strong, practical nature, and he seemed himself to look into futurity as he muttered, "If man can win it, I will." The gypsies traveled but slowly, and although the sun was already high, they had not yet placed many miles between the fugitive and the castle. This, however, was of no great importance. His disguise was so complete, that few would have recognized in the tattered, swarthy vagrant, the smart, soldier-like traveler who had arrived the previous evening at Edeldorf. From the conversation I had overheard in the ghost's gallery, I was alone in the secret, which, strange to say, I forbore to confide even to my friend Victor. But I could not forget the steward and his son. It was my first glimpse into the romance of real life, and I could not help feeling a painful interest in his fortunes, and an eager desire to see him at least safe off with his motley company. I was rejoiced, therefore, at Victor's early proposal, made the very instant we had swallowed our breakfasts, that we should take a ride, and notwithstanding my misgivings about a strange pony, for I was always timid on horseback, I willingly accepted his offer of a mount, and jumped into the saddle almost as readily as my little companion, a true Hungarian, with whom, like Mad Tom, the chiefest care was horse to ride and weapon wear. Of course, Victor had a complete establishment of ponies belonging to himself, and equally of course, he had detailed to me at great length their several merits and peculiarities, with an authentic biography of his favorite a stiff little chestnut, rejoicing in the name of Gold Kind, which, signifying as it does the golden child, or darling, he seemed to think an exceedingly happy allusion to the chestnut skin and endearing qualities of his treasure. Fortunately, my pony was very quiet, and although, when mounted, my playfellow went off at score, we were soon some miles from Edeldorf, without any event occurring to upset my own equilibrium or the sobriety of my steed. Equally fortunately, we took the road by which the gypsies had traveled. Ere long, we overtook the cavalcade as it wound slowly along the plain. Heads were bared to Victor, and blessings called down upon the family of Der Rohan, for the old count was at all times a friend to the friendless, and a refuge to the poor. "Good luck to you, young count. Shall I tell your fortune?" said one. "Little, honorable cavalier, give me your hand, and cross it with a Zwanziger," said another. "Be silent, children, and let me speak to the young Der Rohan," said the gypsy queen, and she laid her hand upon his bridle, and fairly brought Gold Kind to a halt. Victor looked half afraid, although he began to laugh. "Let me go," said he, tugging vigorously at his reins, "Papa desired me not to have my fortune told." "Not by a common zingini," urged the queen, archly, "but I am the mother of all these. My pretty boy, I was at your christening, and have held you in my arms many a time. Let me tell your happy fortune." Victor began to relent. "If Vir will have his told first, I will," said he, turning half bashfully, half eagerly to me. I proffered my hand readily to the gypsy, and crossed it with one of the two pieces of silver which constituted the whole of my worldly wealth. The gypsy laughed, and began to prophesy in German. There are some events a child never forgets, and I remember every word she said as well as if it had been spoken yesterday. Over the sea, and again over the sea, thou shalt know grief and hardship and losses, and the dove shall be driven from its nest. And the dove's heart shall become like the eagle's, that flies alone, and fleshes her beak in the slain. Beat on, though the poor wings be bruised by the tempest, and the breast be sore, and the heart sink, beat on against the wind, and seek no shelter till thou find thy resting place at last. The time will come, only beat on. The woman laughed as she spoke, but there was a kindly tone in her voice and a pitying look in her bright eyes that went straight to my heart. Many a time since, in life, when the storm has indeed been boisterous and the wings so weary, have I thought of those words of encouragement, the time will come, beat on. It was now Victor's turn, and he crossed his palm with a golden ducat ere he presented it to the Sibyl. This was of itself sufficient to ensure him a magnificent future, and as the queen perused the lines on his soft little hand, with its pink fingers, she indulged in anticipations of magnificence proportioned to the handsome donation of the child. Thou shalt be a Dorahan, my darling, and I can promise thee no brighter lot, broad acres, and blessings from the poor, and horses, and wealth, and honors. And the sword shall spare thee, and the battle turn aside to let thee pass. And thou shalt wed a fair bride with dark eyes and a queenly brow, but beware of St. Hubert's day. Birth and burial, beware of St. Hubert's day. But I want to be a soldier, exclaimed Victor, who seemed much disappointed at the future which was prognosticated for him. The Dorahans were always soldiers. Mother, can't you make out I shall be a soldier? Still holding the little hand open. Farewell, my children, was the only answer vouchsafed by the prophetess. I can only read, I cannot write, farewell. And setting the troop in order, she motioned to them to continue their march without further delay. I took advantage of the movement to press near my acquaintance of the day before, whom I had not failed to recognize in his gypsy garb. Poor fellow, my childish heart bled for him, and, in a happy moment, I bethought me of my remaining bit of silver. I stooped from my pony and kissed his forehead, while I squeezed the coin into his hand without a word. The tears came into the deserter's eyes. God bless you, little man. I shall never forget you, was all he said, but I observed that he bit the coin with his large, strong teeth till it was nearly double, and then placed it carefully in his bosom. We turned our ponies, and were soon out of sight, but I never breathed a syllable to Victor about the fugitive, or the steward, or the ghost's gallery, for 2 whole days. Human nature could keep the secret no longer. Chapter 6. School. In one of the pleasantest valleys of sweet Somersetshire stands a large red brick house that bears unmistakably impressed on its exterior the title school. You would not take it for a hall, or an hospital, or an almshouse, or anything in the world but an institution for the rising generation, in which the ways of the wide world are so successfully imitated that, in the qualities of foresight, cunning, duplicity, and general selfishness, the boy may indeed be said to be father to the man. The house stands on a slope towards the south, with a trim lawn and carefully kept gravel drive, leading to a front door, of which the steps are always clean and the handles always bright. How a ring at the doorbell used to bring all our hearts into our mouths. 40 boys were we, sitting grudgingly over our lessons on the bright summer forenoons, and not one of us but thought that ring might possibly announce a something for him from home. Home. What was there in the word, that it should call up such visions of happiness, that it should create such a longing, sickening desire to have the wings of a dove and flee away, that it should make the present such a blank and comfortless reality? Why do we persist in sending our children so early to school? A little boy, with all his affections developing themselves, loving and playful and happy, not ashamed to be fond of his sisters, and thinking mama all that is beautiful and graceful and good, is to be torn from that home which is to him an earthly paradise, and transferred to a place of which we had better not ask the urchin his own private opinion. We appeal to every mother, and it is a mother who is best capable of judging for a child whether her darling returns to her improved in her eyes after his first half year at school. She looks in vain for the pliant, affectionate disposition that a word from her used to be capable of molding at will, and finds instead a stubborn self-sufficient spirit that has been called forth by harsh treatment and intercourse with the mimic world of boys, more selfish and more conventional, because less characteristic than that of men. He is impatient of her tenderness now, nay, half ashamed to return it. Already he aspires to be a man, in his own eyes, and thinks it manly to make light of those affections and endearments by which he once set such store. The mother is no longer all in his heart, her empire is divided and weakened, soon it will be swept away, and she sighs for the white frock days when her child was fondly and entirely her own. Now, I cannot help thinking the longer these days last the better. Anxious parent, what do you wish your boy to become? A successful man in afterlife? Then rear him tenderly and carefully at first. You would not bid a colt at 2 years old, be not less patient with your own flesh and blood. Nature is the best guide, you may depend. Leave him to the whim until his strength is established and his courage high, and when the metal has assumed shape and consistency, to the forge with it as soon as you will. Hardship, buffetings, adversity, all these are good for the underscore youth underscore, but, for heaven's sake, spare the underscore child underscore. 40 boys are droning away at their tasks on a bright sunshiny morning in June, and I am sitting at an old oak desk, begrimed and splashed with the inks of many generations, and hacked by the knives of idler after idler for the last 50 years. I have yet to learn by heart some 2-score lines from the Aeneid. How I hate Virgil whilst I bend over those dog's-eared leaves and that uncomfortable desk. How I envy the white butterfly of which I have just got a glimpse as he soars away into the blue sky, for no terrestrial objects are visible from our schoolroom window to distract our attention and interfere with our labors. I have already accompanied him in fancy over the lawn, and the garden, and the high white thorn fence into the meadow beyond. How well I know the deep glades of that copse for which he is making, how I wish I was on my back in its shadow now. Never mind, today is a half holiday, and this afternoon I will spend somehow in a dear delicious ramble through the fairyland of out of bounds. The rap of our master's cane against his desk, a gentlemanlike method of awakening attention and asserting authority, startles me from my daydream. March, for we drop the Mr. prefixed, in speaking of our pedagogue, March is a bit of a tartar, and I tremble for the result. Edgerton to come up. Edgerton goes up accordingly, with many misgivings, and embarks, like a desperate man, on the loathed underscore infandom Regina Jubes underscore. The result may be gathered from March's observations as he returns me the book. Not a line correct, sir, stand down, sir, the finest passage of the poet shamefully mangled and defaced, it is a perfect disgrace to Everton. Remain until 5, sir, and repeat the whole lesson to Mr. Manners. Please, sir, I tried to learn it, sir, indeed I did, sir. Don't tell me, sir, underscore tried underscore to learn it, indeed. If it had been French or German, or any of these useless branches of learning, you would have had it by heart fast enough, but Latin, sir, Latin is the foundation of a gentleman's education, Latin you are sent here to acquire, and Latin, sir, with an astounding rap on the desk, you underscore shall underscore learn, or I'll know the reason why. I may remark that March, though an excellent scholar, professed utter contempt for all but the dead languages. I determined to make one more effort to save my half-holiday. Please, sir, if I might look over it once more, I could say it when the second class goes down. Please, sir, won't you give me another chance? March was not, in schoolboy parlance, half a bad fellow, and he did give me another chance, and I came up to him once more at the conclusion of school, having repeated the whole 40 lines to myself without missing a word, but, alas! When I stood again on the step which led up to the dreaded desk, and gave away the book into those uncompromising hands, and heard that stern voice with its "Now, sir, begin," my intellects forsook me altogether, and while the floor seemed to rock under me, I made such blunders and confusion of the chief's oration to the lovesick queen, as drove March to the extremity of that very short tether which he was pleased to call his patience, and drew upon myself the dreaded condemnation I had fought so hard to escape. Remain in, sir, till perfect, and repeat to Mr. Manners, without a mistake Mr. Manners, you will be kind enough to see, underscore without a mistake underscore. Boys. With another rap of the cane, school's up. March locks his desk with a bang, and retires. Mr. Manners puts on his hat. 40 boys burst instantaneously into tumultuous uproar, 40 pairs of feet scuffle along the dusty boards, 40 voices break into song and jest and glee, 40 spirits are emancipated from the prison house into freedom and air and sunshine, 40, all save one. So again I turn to the underscore infandom Egina Jubes underscore, and sit me down and cry. I had gone late to school, but I was a backward child in everything save my proficiency in modern languages. I had never known a mother, and the little education I had acquired was picked up in a desultory manner here and there during my travels with my father, and afterwards in a gloomy old library at Alton Grange, his own place in the same county as Mr. March's school. My father had remained abroad till his affairs made it imperative that he should return to England, and for some years we lived in seclusion at Alton, with an establishment that even my boyish penetration could discover was reduced to the narrowest possible limits. I think this was the idlest period of my life. I did no lessons, unless my father's endeavor to teach me painting, An art that I showed year after year less inclination to master, could be called so. I had but few ideas, yet they were very dear ones. I adored my father, on him I lavished all the love that would have been a mother's right, and having no other relations, none in the world that I cared for, or that cared for me, even Nurse Netich having remained in Hungary, my father was all in all. I used to wait at his door of a morning to hear him wake, and go away quite satisfied without letting him know. I used to watch him for miles when he rode out, and walk any distance to meet him on his way home. To please him I would even mount a quiet pony that he had bought on purpose for me, and dissemble my terrors because I saw they annoyed my kind father. I was a very shy, timid, and awkward boy, shrinking from strangers with a fear that was positively painful, and liking nothing so well as a huge armchair in the gloomy oak wainscoted library, where I would sit by the hour reading old poetry, old plays, old novels, and wandering about till I lost myself in a world of my own creating, full of beauty and romance, and all that ideal life which we must perforce call nonsense, but which, were it reality, would make this earth a heaven. Such was a bad course of training for a boy whose disposition was naturally too dreamy and imaginative, too deficient in energy and practical good sense. Had it gone on, I must have become a madman. What is it but madness to live in a world of our own? I shall never forget the breakup of my dreams, the beginning, to me, of hard practical life. I was coiled up in my favorite attitude, buried in the depths of a huge armchair in the library, and devouring with all my senses and all my soul the pages of the underscore Mort d'apostrophe Arthur underscore, that most voluminous and least instructive of romances, but one for which, to my shame be it said, I confess to this day a sneaking kindness. I was gazing on Queen Guinevere, as I pictured her to myself, in scarlet and ermine and pearls, with raven hair plaited over her queenly brow, and soft violet eyes, looking kindly down on mailed Sir Launcelot at her feet. I was holding Arthur's helmet in the forest, as the frank, handsome, stalwart monarch bent over a sparkling rill and cooled his sunburnt cheek, and laved his chestnut beard, whilst the sunbeams flickered through the green leaves and played upon his gleaming corslet and his armor of proof. I was feasting at Camelot with the knights of the Round Table, jesting with Sir Dinadam, discussing grave subjects of high import with Sir Gawain, or breaking a lance in knightly courtesy with Sir Tristram and Sir Bors. In short, I was a child at a spectacle, but the spectacle came and went, and grew more and more gorgeous at will. In the midst of my dreams in walked my father, and sat down opposite the old armchair. "Vere," said he, "you must go to school." The announcement took away my breath. I had never, in my wildest moments, contemplated such a calamity. "To school, Papa, and when?" I mustered up courage to ask, clinging like a convict to the hope of a reprieve. "The first of the month, my boy," answered my father, rather bullying himself into firmness, for I fancy he hated the separation as much as I did. "Mr. March writes me that his scholars will reunite on the first of next month, and he has a vacancy for you. We must make a man of you, there, and young de Rohan, your Hungarian friend, is going there too. You will have lots of playfellows, and get on very well, I have no doubt, and Everton is not so far from here, and you will be very comfortable, I trust, but I am loath to part with you, my dear, and that's the truth." I felt as if I could have endured martyrdom when my father made this acknowledgement. I could do anything if I was only coaxed and pitied a little, and when I saw he was so unhappy at the idea of our separation, I resolved that no word or look of mine should add to his discomfort, although I felt my heart breaking at the thoughts of bidding him goodbye and leaving the Grange, with its quiet regularity and peaceful associations, for the noise and bustle and discipline of a large school. Queen Guinevere and Sir Launcelot faded hopelessly from my mental vision, and in their places rose up stern forms of harsh taskmasters and satirical playfellows, early hours, regular discipline, Latin and Greek, and, worst of all, a continual bustle and a life in a crowd. There were two peculiarities in my boyish character which, more than any others, unfitted me for battling with the world. I had a morbid dread of ridicule, which made me painfully shy of strangers. I have on many an occasion stood with my hand on the lock of a door, dreading to enter the room in which I heard strange voices, and then, plunging in with a desperate effort, have retired again as abruptly, covered with confusion, and so nervous as to create in the minds of the astonished guests a very natural doubt as to my mental sanity. The other peculiarity was an intense love of solitude. I was quite happy with my father, but if I could not enjoy his society, I preferred my own to that of any other mortal. I would take long walks by myself, I would sit for hours and read by myself. I had a bedroom of my own, into which I hated even a servant to set foot, and perhaps the one thing I dreaded more than all besides in my future life was, that I should never, never, be underscore alone underscore. How I prized the last few days I spent at home, How I gazed on all the well-known objects as if I should never see them again, how the very chairs and tables seemed to bid me goodbye like old familiar friends. I had none of the lively anticipations which most boys cherish of the manliness and independence arising from a school life, no long vista of cricket and football, and fame in their own little world, with increasing strength and stature, to end in a tailed coat, and even whiskers. No, I hated the idea of the whole thing. I expected to be miserable at Everton, and, I freely confess, was not disappointed. Chapter 7. Play. Dinner was over, and playtime begun for all but me, and again I turned to the underscore in fandom Regina Jubes underscore, and sat me down to cry. A kind hand, grimed with ink, was laid on my shoulder, a pair of soft blue eyes looked into my face, and Victor de Rohan, my former playfellow, my present fast friend and declared chum, sat down on the form beside me, and endeavored to console me in distress. "I'll help you, Edgerton," said the warm-hearted lad, "say it to me, March is a beast, but Manners is a good fellow, Manners will hear you now, and we shall have our half-holiday after all." I can't," was my desponding reply. "Manners won't hear me, I know, till I am perfect, and I never can learn this stupid sing-song story. How I hate Queen Dido, how I hate Virgil. You should read about Guinevere, Victor, and King Arthur. I'll tell you about them this afternoon," and the tears came again into my eyes as I remembered there was no afternoon for me. "Try once more," said Victor, "I'll get Manners to hear you, leave it to me, I know how to do it. I'll ask Ropesley." And Victor was off into the playground ere I was aware, in search of this valuable auxiliary. Now, Ropesley was the mainspring round which turned the whole of our little world at Everton. If an excuse for a holiday could be found, Ropesley was entreated to ask the desired favour of March. If a quarrel had to be adjusted, either in the usual course of ordeal by battle, or the less decisive method of arbitration, Ropesley was always invited to see fair play. He was the king of our little community. It was whispered that he could spar better than Manners, and construe better than March. He was certainly a more perfect linguist, as indeed I could vouch for from my own knowledge, than Schwartz, who came twice a week to teach us a rich German French. We saw his boots were made by Hobie, and we felt his coats could only be the work of Stelz, for in those days Poole was not, and we were perfectly willing to believe that he wore a scarlet hunting coat in the Christmas holidays, and had visiting cards of his own. In person he was tall and slim, with a pale complexion, and waving, soft brown hair. Without being handsome, he was distinguished looking, and even as a boy, I have seen strangers turn round and ask who he was, but the peculiar feature of his countenance was his light grey eye, veiled with long black eyelashes. It never seemed to kindle or to waver or to wink, it was always the same, hard, penetrating, and unmoved. It never smiled, though the rest of his features would laugh heartily enough, and it certainly never wept. Even in boyhood it was the eye of a cool, calculating, wary man. He knew the secrets of every boy in the school, but no one ever dreamt of cross-questioning Ropesley. We believed he only stayed at Everton as a favor to March, who was immensely proud of his pupil's gentlemanlike manners and appearance, as well as of his scholarly proficiency, although no one ever saw him study, and we always expected Ropesley was going to leave this half. We should not have been the least surprised to hear he had been sent for by the sovereign, and created a peer of the realm on the spot. With all our various opinions, we were unanimous in one creed that nothing was impossible for Ropesley, and he need only try to succeed. For myself, I was dreadfully afraid of this luminary, and looked up to him with feelings of veneration which amounted to positive awe. Not so Victor. The young Hungarian feared, I believe, nothing on earth, and underscore respected underscore but little. He was the only boy in the school who, despite the difference of age, would talk with Ropesley upon equal terms, and if anything could have added to the admiration with which we regarded the latter, it would have been the accurate knowledge he displayed of de Rohan's family, their history, their place in Hungary, all their belongings, as if he himself had been familiar with Adeldorf from boyhood. But so it was with everything. Ropesley knew all about people in general better than they did themselves. Victor rushed back triumphantly into the schoolroom, where I still sat desponding at my desk, and Ropesley followed him. "What's the matter, Vere?" he asked, in a patronizing tone, and calling me by my Christian name, which I esteemed a great compliment. "What's the matter?" he repeated, 40 lines of Virgil to say, "Come, that's not much." "But I underscore can apostrophe T underscore learn it," I urged. "You must think me very stupid, and if it was French, or German, or English, I should not mind twice the quantity, but I cannot learn Latin, and it's no use trying." The older boy sneered, it seemed so easy to him with his powerful mind to get 40 lines of hexameters by heart. I believe he could have repeated the whole __init__ without book from beginning to end. Do you want to go out today, Veer? Said he. I clasped my hands in supplication, as I replied, oh. I would give anything__, to get away from this horrid schoolroom, and shirk out with Victor and Bold. The latter, be it observed, was a dog in whose society I took great delight, and whom I kept in the village, at an outlay of 1 shilling per week, much to the detriment of my personal fortune. Very well, said the great man, come with me to Manners, and bring your book with you. So I followed my deliverer into the playground, with the__ and fandom Regina__ still weighing heavily on my soul. Manners, the usher, was playing cricket with some dozen of the bigger boys, and was in the act of going for a sixer. His coat and waistcoat were off, and his shirt sleeves tucked up, disclosing his manly arms bare to the elbow, and Manners was in his glory, for, notwithstanding the beard upon his chin, our usher was as very a boy at heart as the youngest urchin in the lower class. A dandy, too, was Manners, and a wight of an imaginative turn of mind, which chiefly developed itself in the harmless form of bright visions for the future, teeming with romantic adventures, of which he was himself to be the hero. His past he seldom dwelt upon. His aspirations were military, his ideas extravagant. He was great on the peninsula and Lord Anglesey at Waterloo, and had patent boxes in his high-heeled boots that only required the addition of heavy clanking spurs to complete the illusion that Mr. Manners ought to be a cavalry officer. Of his riding he spoke largely, but his proficiency in this exercise we had no means of ascertaining. There were two things, however, on which Manners prided himself, and which were a source of intense amusement to the urchins by whom he was surrounded. These were, his personal strength, and his whiskers. The former quality was encouraged to develop itself by earnest application to all manly sports and exercises. The latter ornaments were cultivated and enriched with every description of nutrifier, regenerator, and unguent known to the hairdresser or the advertiser. Alas! Without effect proportioned to the perseverance displayed, two small patches of fluff under the jawbones, that showed to greatest advantage by candlelight, being the only evidence of so much painstaking and cultivation thrown away. Of his muscular prowess, however, it behoved us to speak with reverence. Was it not on record in the annals of the school that when the King of Naples, our dissipated pieman, endeavored to justify by force an act of dishonesty by which he had done Timmins Minor out of half a crown, Manners stripped at once to his shirt sleeves, and went in at the monarch with all the vigor and activity of some 23 summers against 80? The monarch, a truculent old ruffian, with a red neckcloth, half boots, and one eye, fought gallantly for a few rounds, and was rather getting the best of it, when, somewhat unaccountably, he gave in, leaving the usher master of the field. Ropesley, who gave his friend an E__ secundum artem__, and urged him, with frequent injunctions, to fight high, attributed this easy victory to the forbearance of their antagonist, who had a night of future trade and mercantile profits. But Manners, whose account of the battle I have heard more than once, always scouted this view of the transaction. He went down, sir, as if he was shot, he would say, doubling his arm, and showing the muscles standing out in bold relief. Few men have the biceps so well developed as mine, and he went down__ as if he was shot_. If I had hit him as hard as I could, sir, I must_ have killed him. Our usher was a good-natured fellow, notwithstanding. I'll hear you in 10 minutes, Edgerton, said he, when I have had my innings, and forthwith he stretched himself into attitude, and prepared to strike. Better give me your bat, remarked Ropesley, who was too lazy to play cricket in a regular manner. Of course, Manners consented, nobody ever refused Ropesley anything, and in 10 minutes' time I had repeated the__ and fandom Regina_, and Ropesley had added some dozen masterly hits to the usher's score. Ropesley always liked another man's innings better than his own. Now the regulations at Everton, as they were excessively strict, and based upon the principle that Apollo should always keep the bow at the utmost degree of tension, so were they alluded upon every available opportunity, and set at naught and laughed at by the youngest urchins in the school. We had an ample playground for our minor sports, and a meadow beyond, in which we were permitted to follow the exhilarating pastime of cricket, the share of the younger boys in that exciting amusement being limited to a pursuit of the ball round the field, and a prompt return of the same to their seniors, doubtless a necessary ingredient in this noble game, but one which is not calculated to excite enthusiastic pleasure in the youthful mind. From the playground and its adjacent meadow it was a capital offence to absent oneself. All the rest of Somersetshire was out of bounds, and to be caught out of bounds was a crime for which corporal punishment was the invariable reward. At the same time, the offense was, so to speak, winked at. No inquiries were made as to how we spent half holidays between 1 o'clock and 7, and many a glorious ramble we used to have during those precious 6 hours in all the ecstasy of freedom, a word understood by none better than the schoolboy. A certain deference was, however, exacted to the regulations of the establishment. By a sort of tacit compact, it seemed to be understood that our code was so far Spartan as to make, not the crime, but the being found out, a punishable offense, and boys were always supposed to take their chance. If seen any act of escaping, or afterwards met by any of the masters in the surrounding country, we were liable to be flogged, and to do March justice, we always flogged, and pretty soundly, too. Under these circumstances, some little care and circumspection had to be observed in starting for our rambles. Certain steps had been made in the playground wall, where it was hidden from the house by the stem of a fine old elm, and by dropping quietly down into an orchard beyond an orchard, be it observed, of which the fruit was always plucked before it reached maturity and then stealing along the back of a thick, high hedge, we could get fairly away out of sight of the school windows, and so make our escape. Now, on the afternoon in question we had planned an expedition in which Victor, and I, and my dog Bold had determined to be principal performers. Of the latter personage in the trio I must remark, that no party of pleasure on which we embarked was ever supposed to be perfect without his society. His original possessor was the King of Naples, whom I have already mentioned, and who, I conclude, stole him, as he appeared one day tied to that personage by an old cotton handkerchief, and looking as woebegone and unhappy as a retriever puppy of some 3 months old, torn from his mama and his brothers and sisters, and the comfortable kennel in which he was brought up, and transferred to the tender mercies of a drunken, poaching, dog-stealing ruffian, was likely to feel in so false a position. The king brought him into our playground on one of his tart-selling visits, as a specimen of the rarest breed of retrievers known in the west of England. The puppy seemed so thoroughly miserable, and looked up at me so piteously, that I forthwith asked his price, and after a deal of haggling, and a consultation between de Rohan and myself, I determined to become his purchaser, at the munificent sum of 1 sovereign, of which 10 shillings, my all, were to be paid on the spot, and the other 10 to remain, so to speak, on mortgage upon the animal, with the further understanding that he should be kept at the residence of the King of Naples, who, in consideration of the regular payment of 1 shilling per week, bound himself to feed the same and complete his education in all the canine branches of plunging, diving, fetching and carrying, on a system of his own, which he briefly described as frustrate. With a deal of prompting for manners, I got through my 40 lines, and he shut the book with a good-natured smile as Ropesley threw down the bat he had been wielding so skillfully, and put on his coat. "Come and lunch with me at the club," said he to Manners, whom he led completely by the nose. "I'll give you Dutch cheese, and sherry and soda water, and a cigar. Hi! There, you ungrateful little ruffian, where are you off to? I want you." I was making my escape as rapidly as possible at the mention of the club, a word which we younger boys held in utter fear and detestation, as being associated in our minds with much perilous enterprise and gratuitous suffering. The club consisted of an old bent tree and a retired corner of the playground, on the trunk of which Ropesley had caused a comfortable seat to be fashioned for his own delectation, and here, in company with Manners and 2 or 3 senior boys, it was his custom to sit smoking and drinking curious compounds, of which the ingredients, being contraband, had to be fetched by us, at the risk of corporal punishment, from the village of Everton, an honest half-mile journey at the least. Ropesley tendered a large cigar to Manners, lit one himself, settled his long limbs comfortably on the seat, and gave me his orders. 1 Dutch cheese, 3 pottles of strawberries now attend, confound you. 2 bottles of old sherry from the Greyhound, mind, the old sherry, 1/2 dozen of soda water, and a couple of pork pies. Put the whole into a basket, they'll give you 1 at the bar, if you say it's for me, and tell them to put it down to my account. Put a clean napkin over the basket, and if you dirty the napkin or break the bottles, I'll break_your_head. Now be off. Manners, I'll take your 2 to 1 he does it without a mistake, and is back here under the 5 and 20 minutes. I did not dare disobey, but I was horribly disgusted at having to employ any portion of my half-holiday in so uncongenial a manner. I rushed back into the schoolroom for my cap, and held a hurried consultation with Victor as to our future proceedings. "He only got you off because he wanted you to shirk out for him," exclaimed my indignant chum. "It's a shame, _that_it is. Don't go for him, there, let's get out quietly, and be off to Beverly. It's the last chance, so old Nap says, This was an abbreviation for the King of Naples, who was in truth a great authority both with Victor and myself, and it's underscore such underscore a beautiful afternoon. But what a licking I shall get from Ropesley, I interposed, with considerable misgivings. He's sure to say I'm an ungrateful little beast. I don't like to be called ungrateful, Victor, and I don't like to be called a little beast. Oh, never mind the names, and a licking is soon over, replied Victor, who learned little from his underscore Horace underscore save the underscore carpe diem underscore philosophy, and who looked upon the licking with considerably more resignation than did the probable recipient. We shall just have time to do it, if we start now. Come on, old fellow, be plucky for once, and come on. I was not proof against the temptation. The project was a long-planned one, and I could not bear the thoughts of giving it up now. Many a time in our rambles had we surmounted the hill that looked down upon Beverley Manor, and viewed it from afar as a sort of unknown fairyland. What a golden time one's boyhood was! A day at Beverley was our dream of all that was most exciting in adventure, most voluptuous in delight, and now Nap had promised to accompany us to this earthly paradise, and show us what he was pleased to term its hins and outs. Not all the cheeses of Holland should prevent my having one day's liberty and enjoyment. I weighed well the price, the certain licking, and the sarcastic abuse which I feared even more, and I think I held my half-holiday all the dearer for having to purchase it at such a cost. We were across the playground like lapwings. Ropesley, who was deep in his cigar and a copy of underscore Bell's Life underscore, which forbidden paper he caused Manners to take in for him surreptitiously, never dreamed that his behests could be treated with contempt, and hardly turned his head to look at us. We surmounted the wall with an agility born of repeated practice, we stole along the adjacent orchard, under covert of the well-known friendly hedge, and only breathed freely when we found ourselves completely out of sight of the house, and swinging along the Everton Lane at a schoolboy's jog, which, like the Highlanders, is equivalent to any other person's gallop. No pair of carriage horses can step together like two schoolboy chums who are in the constant habit of being late in company. Little boys as we were, Victor and I could do our 5 miles in the hour without much difficulty, keeping step like clockwork, and talking the whole time. In 5 minutes we were at the wicket of a small tumble-down building, with dilapidated windows and a ruinous thatched roof, which was in fact the dwelling of no less a personage than the King of Naples, but was seldom alluded to by that worthy in more definite terms than the old place, or my shop, and this only when in a particularly confidential mood, its existence being usually indicated by a jerk of the head towards his blind side, which was supposed to infer proper caution, and a decorous respect for the sanctity of private life. It was indeed one of those edifices of which the word tenement seems alone to convey an adequate description. The garden produced consisted of a ragged shirt and a darned pair of worsted stockings, whilst a venerable buck rabbit looked solemnly out from a hutch on one side of the doorway, and a pair of red-eyed ferrets shed their fragrance from a rough deal box on the other. Nap himself was not to be seen on a visitor's first entrance into his habitation, but generally appeared after a mysterious delay, from certain back settlements, of which one never discovered the exact whereabout. A grimy old woman, with her skirts pinned up, was invariably washing the staircase when we called, and it was only in obedience to her summons that Nap himself could be brought forward. This dame possessed a superstitious interest in the eyes of us boys, on account of the mysterious relationship in which she stood to Nap. He always addressed her as mother, but no boy at Everton had yet ascertained whether this was a generic term significant of age and sex, an appellation of endearment to a spouse, or a tribute of filial reverence from a son. Come, Nap, look alive, holloaed Victor, as we rushed up the narrow path that led from the wicket to the door, in breathless haste not to lose the precious moments of our half-holiday. Now, mother, where is he? Added the lively young truant. Time's up, Nap Nap. And the walls echoed to Victor's rich, laughing voice, and half-foreign accent. As usual, after an interval of a few minutes, Nap himself appeared at the back door of the cottage, with a pair of greased half-boots in one hand, and a ferret, that nestled confidingly against his cheek, in the other. Sarvis, young gentleman, said Nap, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. Sarvis, my lord, Sarvis, Muster Egerton, repeated he, on recognizing his two staunchest patrons. Here, bold. Bold. You do know your master, sure lie, as Bold came rollicking forth from the backyard in which he lived, and testified his delight by many ungainly gambols and puppy-like freedoms, which were responded to as warmly by his delighted owner. My scale of affections at this period of life was easily defined. I loved three objects in the world, viz., my father, Victor, and Bold. I verily believe I cared for nothing on earth but those three, and certainly my dog came in for his share of regard. Bold, although in all the awkwardness of puppyhood, was already beginning to show symptoms of that sagacity which afterwards developed itself into something very few degrees inferior to reason, if indeed it partook not of that faculty which we men are anxious to assume as solely our own. He would already obey the slightest sign, would come to heel at a whisper from his owner or instructor, would drag up huge stones out of 10 feet of water, with ludicrous energy and perseverance, and stand waiting for further orders with his head on one side, and an expression of comic intelligence on his handsome countenance that was delightfully ridiculous. He promised to be of great size and strength, and even at this period, when he put his four paws on my shoulders and licked my face, he was considerably the larger animal of the two. Such familiarities, however, were much discouraged by Nap. "If so be as you would keep a dog, real sporting and dog-like, master," that philosopher would observe, "let on know his distance, I strikes him whenever I can reach him. Fondlin' of him only spiles him same as women." Chapter 8. The Truants. So the day to which we had looked forward with such delight had arrived at last. Our spirits rose as we got further and further from Everton, and we never stopped to take breath or to look back till we found ourselves surmounting the last hill above Beverley Manor. By this time we had far outstripped our friend Nap, that worthy deeming it inconsistent with all his maxims ever to hurry himself. "Slow and sure, young gentleman," he observed soon after we started, "slow and sure wins the day. Dae go on ahead, and wait for I top of Buttercup Close. I gets on better ardor and drop a drink this hot weather. Never fear, squire, I'll not fail ye. Bold. Bold. You go on with your master." So Nap turned into the Cat and Fiddle, and we pursued our journey alone, not very sorry to be rid of our companion for the present, as, notwithstanding our great admiration for his many resources, his knowledge of animal life, his skillful method with rats, and general manliness of character, we could not but be conscious of our own inferiority in these branches of science, and of a certain want of community in ideas between two young gentlemen receiving a polite education at Everton, and a rat-catching, dog-stealing poacher of the worst class. "It's as hot as Hungary," said Victor, seating himself on a stile, and taking off his cap to fan his handsome, heated face. "Oh, there, I wish I was back in the fatherland. Do you remember the great wood at Hadeldorf, and the boar we saw close to the ponies? And oh, there, how I should like to be upon Goldkind once again." "Yes, Victor, I remember it all," I answered, as I flung myself down among the buttercups, and turned my cheek to the cool air that came up the valley, a breeze that blew from the distant hills to the southward, and swept across many a mile of beauty arid side amongst the woods of Beverley, and rippled the wide surface of the mere. "I shall never forget Hadeldorf, nor my first friend, Victor. But what made you think of Hungary just now?" "Why, your beautiful country," answered Victor, pointing to the luxuriant scene below us, a scene that could exist in England only of rich meadows, and leafy copses, and green slopes laughing in the sunlight, dotted with huge old standard trees, and the deep shades of Beverley, with the white garden wall standing out from amongst yew hedges, and rare pines, and exotic evergreens, while the grey turrets of the manor house peeped and peered here and there through the giant elms that stirred and flickered in the summer breeze. The mere was glittering at our feet, and the distant uplands melting away into the golden haze of summer. Child as I was, I could have cried, without knowing why, as I sat there on the grass, drinking in beauty at every pore. What is it that gives to all beauty, animate or inanimate, a tinge of melancholy? The greater the beauty, the deeper the tinge. Is it an instinct of mortality? The bright must fade of the poet? A shadowy regret for Dives, who, no more than Lazarus, can secure enjoyment for a day? Or is it a vague yearning for something more perfect still? A longing of the soul for the unattainable, which, more than all the philosophy in the universe, argues the necessity of a future state? I could not analyze my feelings. I did not then believe that others experienced the same sensations as myself. I only knew that, like Parson Hugh, I had great dispositions to cry. "I wish I were a man, there," remarked Victor, as he pulled out his knife, and began to carve a huge V on the top bar of the stile. "I should like to be grown up now, and you too, there, what a life we would lead. Let me see, I should have 6 horses for myself, and 4 for you, and a pack of hounds, like Mr. Barker's, that we saw last half, coming home from hunting, and 2 rifles, both double-barreled. Do you know, I hit the bull's-eye with Papa's rifle, when Prince Voxel was at Hadeldorf, and he said I was the best shot in Hungary for my age. Look at that crow, there, perching on the branch of the old hawthorn. I could put a bullet into him from here. Oh, I wish I had Papa's rifle." "But should you not like to be king of Hungary, Victor?" said I, for I admired my chum so ardently, that I believed him fit for any position, however exalted. "Should you not like to be king, and ride about upon a white horse, with a scarlet tunic and pelisse, and ostrich feathers in your hat, bowing right and left to the ladies at the windows, with a Hungarian bodyguard clattering behind you, and the people shouting and flinging up their caps in the street? I saw it all in my mind's eye, and fancied my friend the hero of the procession. Victor hesitated, and shook his head. I think I had rather be a general of division, like Wallenstein, and command 10,000 cavalry, or better still, there, ride and shoot as well as Prince Vauxhall, and go up into the mountains after deer, and kill bears and wolves and wild boars, and do what I like. Wouldn't I just pack up my books, and snap my fingers at March, and leave Everton tomorrow, if I could take you with me? But you, there, if you could have your own way, what would you be? I was not long answering, for there was scarcely a day that I did not consider the subject, but my aspirations for myself were so humble, that I hesitated a little lest Victor should laugh at me, before I replied. Oh, I will do whatever my father wishes, Victor, and I hope he will sometimes let me go to you, but if I could do exactly what I liked, if a fairy was at this moment to come out of that bluebell and offer me my choice, I should ask to be a doctor, Victor, and to live somewhere on this hill. _Sacramento!_exclaimed Victor, swearing, in his astonishment, his father's favorite oath a doctor, there. And why? Well, I answered, modestly, I am not like you, Victor, I wish I were. Oh, you cannot tell how I wish I were you. To be high-born and rich, and heir to a great family, and to have everybody making up to one and admiring one, that is what I should call happiness. But I can never have the chance of that. I am shy and stupid and awkward, and, Victor, I got it out at last, blushing painfully. I know that I am ugly _so ugly_. It is foolish to care about it, for, after all, it is not my fault, but I cannot help wishing for beauty. It is so painful to be remarked and laughed at, and I know people laugh at _me_. Why, I heard Ropesley say to Manners, only yesterday, after I had been fagging for him at cricket, why, what an ugly little beggar it is. And Manners said, yes, and he thought it must be a great misfortune. And Ropesley laughed so, I felt he must be laughing at me, as if I could help it. Oh, Victor, you cannot think how I long to be loved, that is why I should like to be a doctor. I would live up here in a small cottage, from which I could always see this beautiful view, and I would study hard to be very clever, not at Greek and Latin, like March, but at something I could take an interest in, and I would have a quiet pony, not a rantipole like your favorite gold kind, and I would visit the poor people for miles round, and never grudge time nor pains for anyone in affliction or distress. I would make them fond of me, and it would be such happiness to go out on a day like this, and see a kind smile for one on everybody's face, good or bad. Nobody loves me now, Victor, except Papa and you and Bold, and Papa, I fear, only because he is my Papa. I heard him say one day, long ago, to my nurse, you remember Nurse Nedich? Never mind what the boy is like, he is my own. I fear he does not care for me for myself. You like me, Victor, because you are used to me, and because I like _you_ so much, but that is not exactly the sort of liking I mean, and as for Bold here, Bold. Bold. Why, what has become of the dog? He must have gone back to look for Nap. Sure enough, Bold was nowhere visible, having made his escape during our conversation, but in his place the worthy King of Naples was to be seen toiling up the hill, more than three parts drunk, and with a humorous twinkle in his solitary eye which betokened mischief. Now, young gents, observed the poacher, settling himself upon the stile, and producing from the capacious pockets of his greasy velveteen jacket an assortment of snares, nightlines, and other suspicious-looking articles, now, young gents, I promise to show you a bit of sport coming here to Beverly, and a bit of sport we'll have. First and foremost, I've agate to lift a line or two as I set yesterday in the mirror, then we'll just take a turn round the pheasantry, for you young gentlemen to see the fowls, you know, Sir Harry, he bain't a coming back till next week, and Muster Barrels, the keeper, he's off into Norfolk, arter Pinters, and such like. You keep the dog well at heel, Squire. Why, whatever has become of Bold? Alas, Bold himself was heard to answer the question. Self-hunting in an adjoining covert, his deep-toned voice was loudly awakening the echoes, and scaring the game all over the manor, to his own unspeakable delight and our intense dismay. Forgetful of all the precepts of his puppyhood, he scampered hither and thither, now in headlong chase of a hare, now dashing aside after a rabbit, putting up pheasants at every stride, and congratulating himself on his emancipation and his prowess in notes that could not fail to indicate his pursuits to keepers, watchers, all the establishment of Beverly Manor, to say nothing of the inhabitants of that and the adjoining parishes. Off we started in pursuit, bounding down the hill at our best pace. Old Nap making run in his own peculiar gait, which was none of the most graceful. Victor laughing and shouting with delight, and I frightened out of my wits at the temporary loss of my favorite, and the probable consequences of his disobedience. Long before we could reach the scene of Bold's misdoings, we had been observed by two men who were fishing in the mere, and who now gave chase the one keeping along the valley, so as to cut us off in our descent, the other, a long-legged fellow, striding right up the hill at once, in case we should turn tail and beat a retreat. Nap suddenly disappeared. I have reason to believe he ensconced himself in a deep ditch, and there remained until the danger had passed away. Victor and I were still descending the hill, calling frantically to Bold. The keeper who had taken the lower line of pursuit was gaining rapidly upon us. I now saw that he carried a gun under his arm. My dog flashed out of a small belt of young trees in hot pursuit of a hare, tongue out, head down, and tail lowered, in full enjoyment of the chase. At the instant he appeared, the man in front of me stopped dead short. Quick as lightning he lifted his long shining barrel. I saw the flash, and ere I heard the report my dog tumbled heels overhead, and lay upon the sunny sward, as I believed in the agony of that moment, stone dead. I strained every nerve to reach him, for I could hear the rattle of the ramrod, as the keeper reloaded, and I determined to cover Bold with my body, and, if necessary, to die with him. I was several paces ahead of Victor, whom I now heard calling me by name, but I could think of nothing, attend to nothing, but the prostrate animal in front. What a joy it was when I reached him to find he was not actually killed. His foreleg was frightfully mangled by the charge, but as I fell breathless by the side of my darling Bold, he licked my face, and I knew there was a chance for him still. A rough grasp was laid on Toy's shoulder, and a hoarse voice roused me. "Come, young man, I thought I'd drop on to you at last. Now you'll just come with me to Sir Harry, and we'll see what __ has to say to this here." And on looking up I found myself in the hands of a strong, square-built fellow, with a velveteen jacket, and a double-barreled gun under his arm, being no less a person than Sir Harry Beverley's head keeper, and the identical individual that had been watching us from the mere, and had made so successful a shot at Bold. "Come, leave the dog," he added, giving me another shake, and scrutinizing my apparel, which was evidently not precisely of the description he had expected. "Leave the dog, it's no great odds about him, and as for young gentleman, if you be a young gentleman, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. It's not one as drove you to this trade. Come, none of that, you go quietly along of me, it's best for you, I tell you." I was struggling to free myself from his hold, for I could not bear to leave my dog. A thousand horrible anticipations filled my head. Trial, transportation, I knew not what, for I had a vague terror of the law, and had heard enough of its rigors in regard to the offense of poaching, to fill me with indescribable alarm, yet, through it all, I was more concerned for Bold than myself. My favorite was dying, I believed, and I could not leave him. I looked up in the face of my captor. He was a rough, hairy fellow, but there was an expression of kindliness in his homely features which encouraged me to entreat for mercy. "Oh, sir," I pleaded, "let me only take my dog, he's not so very heavy, I'll carry him myself. Bold, my darling Bold. He is my own dog, and I'd rather you kill me too than force me to leave him here." The man was evidently mollified, and a good deal puzzled into the bargain. I saw my advantage, and pressed it vigorously. "I'll go to prison willingly, I'll go anywhere you tell me, only do try and cure Bold. Papa will pay you anything if you'll only cure Bold. Victor. Victor," I added, seeing my chum now coming up, likewise in custody, "help me to get this gentleman to save Bold." Victor looked flushed, and fiercer than I ever remembered to have seen that pretty boyish face. His collar was torn and his dress disordered. He had evidently struggled manfully with his captor, and the latter wiped his heated brow with an expression of mingled amusement and astonishment, that showed he was clearly at his wits' end what to make of his prize. "Blowed if I know what to say of this here, Mr. Barrels," said he to his brother functionary. "This little chap's even gamer nor t'other one. __ I never see such a one or to run. If it hadn't been for the big hedge at the corner of the cow pasture, I'd never a cotch ton in a month of Sundays, and when I went to lay hold, the young warmint out with his knife and offered to whip it into me. He's a rare boy this, I could scarce grip him for laughing, but the lad's got a sperrit, blessed if he ain't. I cut my own knuckles gettin' of it out of his hands." And he showed Victor's knife to his comrade as he spoke. Mr. Barrels was a man of reflection, as keepers generally are. He examined the knife carefully, and spoke in an undertone to his friend. "Do you see this here?" he remarked, pointing to the coronet which was inlaid in the steel, "and do you see that there?" he added, with a glance at Victor's gold watch chain, of Parisian fabric. "Put this here and that there together, Bill, which it convinces me as these here little chaps is not them as we was a-looking for. Your cove looks a gentleman all over, I knows the breed, Bill, and there's no mistake about the real thing, and my precious boy here, he wouldn't leave the dog, not if it was ever so, though he's a very little un, he's a gentleman too, but that don't make no odds, Bill, gentlemen hadn't ought to be up to such like tricks, nor haven't half the excuse of poor folks, and, gentlemen or no gentlemen, they goes before Sir 'Arry, dog and all, as sure as my name's Barrels." Victor and I looked at each other in hopeless despair. There was, then, nothing for it but to undergo the extreme penalty of the law. With hanging heads and blushing cheeks we walked between our captors, Bill, who seemed a good-natured fellow enough, carrying the unfortunate bolt on his shoulders. We thought our shame had reached its climax, but we were doomed to suffer even more degradation in this our first visit to Beverly Manor. As we threaded the gravel path of a beautiful shrubbery leading to the back offices of the manor house, we met a young girl taking her afternoon's walk with her governess, whose curiosity seemed vividly excited by our extraordinary procession. To this day I can remember Constance Beverly as she stood before me then, the first time I ever saw her. She was scarcely more than a child, but her large serious dark eyes, her noble and somewhat sad expression of countenance, gave her an interest which mere childish beauty could never have possessed. There are some faces that we can discern even at such a distance as renders the features totally indistinct, as if the expression of countenance reached us by some magnetic process independent of vision, and such a face was that of Constance Beverly. I have often heard her beauty disputed. I have even known her called plain, though that was generally by critics of her own sex, but I never heard anyone deny that she was underscore uncommon looking underscore, and always certain to attract attention, even where she failed in winning admiration. Victor blushed scarlet, and I felt as if I must sink into the earth when this young lady walked up to the keeper, and asked him what he was going to do with those people, and why he was taking them to Papa. Miss Constance was evidently a favorite with Mr. Barrels, for he stopped and doffed his hat with much respect whilst he explained to her the circumstance of our pursuit and capture. So long as he alluded only to our poaching offenses, I thought the little lady looked on us with eyes of kindly commiseration, but when he hinted his suspicions of our social position, I observed that she immediately assumed an air of marked coldness, and transferred her pity to bold. "So you see, miss, it is my duty by Sir 'Arry without respect to rich or poor," was Mr. Barrel's conclusion to a long-winded oration addressed partly to the young lady, partly to her governess, and partly to ourselves, the shame-faced culprits, "and therefore it is as I brings these young gentlemen up to the justice room, if so be, as I said before, they underscore be underscore young gentlemen, and so, Miss Constance, the law must take its course. But you'll take care of the poor dog, Barrels, promise me you'll take care of the poor dog," was the young lady's last entreaty as she walked on with her governess, and a turn in the shrubbery hid her from our sight. "Underscore what underscore a half holiday this has been," whispered I to my comrade in distress, as we neared the house that had so long been an object of such curiosity. "Yes," replied Victor, "but it's not over yet. Sir 'Arry was at the farm, we must wait for his return." Meantime we were shown into the servants' hall, a large stone chamber devoid of furniture, that reminded me of our schoolroom at Everton. Much as we hated the latter, what would we have given to be there now? Cold meat and ale were offered us, but, as may well be imagined, we had no appetite to partake of them, although in that respect our captors set us a noble example, remaining, however, on either side of us as turnkeys watch those who are ordered for execution. The servants of the household came one after another to stare at the unfortunate culprits, and made audible remarks on our dress and general appearance. Victor's beauty won him much favor from the female part of the establishment, and a housemaid with a wonderfully smart cap brought him a cup of tea, which he somewhat rudely declined. There was considerable discussion as to our real position in society carried on without the slightest regard to our presence. The under-butler, whose last place was in London, and whose professional anxiety about his spoons may have somewhat prejudiced him, gave it as his opinion that we belonged to what he called the swell mob, but Mr. Barrels, who did not seem to understand the term, pooh-poohed this suggestion with so much dignity as at once to extinguish that official, who incontinently retired to his pantry in his native obscurity. The women, who generally leaned to the most improbable version of a story, were inclined to believe that we were sailors, and of foreign extraction, but the most degrading theory of all, and one that I am bound to confess met with a large majority of supporters, was to the effect that we were runaway prentices from Fleetsbury, and would be put in the stocks on our return to that market town. We had agreed not to give our names except as a last resource, my friend clinging, as I thought somewhat hopelessly, to the idea that Sir Harry would let us off with a reprimand, and we might get back to Everton without March finding it out. So the great clock ticked loudly in the hall, and there we sat in mute endurance. As Victor had before remarked, it was not over yet. Chapter 9. Ropesley. Ropesley smoked his cigar on the trunk of the old tree, and Manners drank in worldly wisdom from the lips of his junior, whom, however, he esteemed as the very guidebook of all sporting and fashionable life. It was the ambition of our usher to become a thorough man of the world, and, had he been born to a fortune and a title, there was no reason why he should not have formed a very fair average young nobleman. His tastes were frivolous enough, his egotism sufficiently developed, his manner formed on what he conceived the best model. All this was only absurd, I presume, because he was an usher. Had he been a marquis, he would have shone forth as a very charming person. His admiration of Ropesley was genuine, the latter's contempt for his adorer equally sincere, but better concealed. They sit puffing away at their cigars, watching the smoke wreathing up into the summer sky, and Manners coaxes his whiskers and looks admiringly at his friend. Ropesley's cigar is finished, and he dashes it down somewhat impatiently. "What can have become of that little wretch?" says he, with a yawn and a stretch of his long, well-shaped limbs. "He's probably made some stupid mistake, and I shall have to lick him after all. Manners, what have you done with the old dog whip we used to keep for the lower boys?"
"Safe in my desk," replies Manners, who, being a good-natured fellow, likes to keep that instrument of torture locked up. "But Edgerton's a good little fellow, you mustn't be too hard upon him this time."
"I never could see the difference between a good fellow and a bad one," replies Ropesley. "If I want a thing done, I choose the most likely person to do it, and if he fails, it's his fault and not mine, and he must suffer for it. I've no prejudices, my good friend, and no feelings. They're only different words for the same thing, and, depend upon it, people get on much better without them. But come, let's walk down to the village, and look after him. I'll go and ask March if he wants anything down the road." Luckily for me, my chastiser had not proceeded half a mile upon his way, ere he met the King of Naples in person, hot and breathless, flustered with drink and running, and more incoherent than usual in his conversation and demeanor. He approached Ropesley, who was the most magnificent of his patrons, with hat in hand, and somewhat the air of a dog that knows he has done wrong. "What's up now, you old reprobate?" said the latter, in his most supercilious manner. "A manner, I may observe, he adopted to all whom he could influence without conciliating, and which made the conciliation doubly winning to the favored few. What's up now? Drunk again, I suppose, as usual?"
"Not drunk, squire, not drunk, as I'm a living man," replied the poacher, sawing the air in deprecation with a villainously dirty hand, agitated, perhaps, and over-anxious about the young gentleman. "Oh, them lads, them lads." And he leered at his patron as much as to hint that he had a precious story to tell, if it was only made worth his while.
"Come, no nonsense," said Ropesley, sternly, "out with it. What's the matter? You've got De Rohan and Edgerton into some scrape, I see it in your ugly old face. Tell me all about it this instant, or it will be worse for you."
"Doan't hurry a man so, squire, pray ye, now, doan't. I be only out of breath, and the lads they be safe enough by this time, but I wanted for you to speak up for me to the master, squire. I bain't a morsel to blame. I went a purpose to see as the young gents didn't get into no mischief, I did, indeed. I be an old man now, and it's a long walk for me at my years," whined the old rascal, who was over at the manor 3 nights a week when he thought the keepers were out of the way. "And the dog, he was most to blame, arter all, but the keepers they've got the young gents safe, enough, and that's all about it." So saying, he stood bolt upright, like a man who has fired his last shot, and is ready to abide the worst. Truth to tell, the King of Naples was horribly afraid of Ropesley. The latter thought for a moment, put his hand in his pocket, and gave the poacher half a crown. "You hold your tongue," said he, "or you'll get into worse trouble than any of them. Now go home, and don't let me hear of your stirring out for 24 hours. Be off. Do you hear?" Old Nap obeyed, and hobbled off to his cottage, there to spend the term of his enforced residence in his favorite occupation of drinking, while Ropesley walked rapidly on to the village, and directed his steps to that well-known inn, the Greyhound, of which every boy at Everton School was more or less a patron. In 10 minutes' time there was much ringing of bells and general confusion pervading that establishment. The curly-headed waiter, why do all waiters have